the fans, by the fans, this is the Non-League Football Show, and I'm Tim Fuel, back with another weekly look at the world of non-league football. A slight change of pace this week, no cup competitions to be chasing, so we get a chance to talk about topics we might otherwise not get to. In a week when the BBC are citing the awful statistics of referees being abused, being injured or attacked, we speak with old friend of the show, Martin Cassidy, CEO of the independent charity Ref Support. He's actually in a positive mood. Not that the darker side of football isn't there, but that the publicity means things are a-changing, with the FA looking at body cam rollouts to help referees, help players, and help us all enjoy the game. Our next guest also has a tale to tell. His side were 3-0 down with 8 minutes of normal time to play and a real six-pointer, a potential relegation battle too. Not only did they then go on to win 4-3 deep into injury time, but their goalkeeper was the one that scored the equaliser. Amit Rifat has been at Wingate and Finchley for nearly a decade and a half as player, director of football, probably just about every other job under the sun, and now manager. And he's likely to put this down as one of his favourite memories. Rounding it all up is John Couch, executive editor at the Non-League Paper, as the season really does begin to reach the exciting final third. So sit back, relax, and let's get matters underway. So you've probably seen much in the mainstream media this week about grassroots referees, the abuse they get, the thankless tasks they perform in wind, in rain, and often in hostile situations. It's unfortunately nothing new. It's a topic we've covered many times over the years, and often with my next guest. But I thought it a timely reminder of the good work and advocacy his organisation does, but also a chance to hear from the officials as to maybe how all of us at Non-League could help things run a little smoother. Let's give a warm welcome back to the Non-League Football Show to CEO at independent charity Ref Support, Mr. Martin Cassidy. Welcome back, Martin.
How you doing, mate? It's good to talk to you again.
It's always good to talk to you, Martin, because we never have enough time, actually. So let's crack on. Look, this week, the BBC Five Live, they sent out via the Referees Association questionnaires, got back, I think, 900 with 293 respondents saying they'd been physically abused by spectators, players, coaches or managers. Almost all the respondents had experienced some form of verbal abuse. So I guess the question for me is, why do they do it, Martin? What makes a referee want to be a referee?
Well, first of all, thanks for covering the subject again. The more people who talk about it like this, the better. And interestingly, the Referee Association, there's more people in every single county FA in the country not in the Referee Association than in it. Now, they say they've got about 7,000 members, something like that. There's probably about 2,000 of them that are active. So overall, it's a very small minority. So if you think of those numbers that they've got, what's it like with the people that aren't involved, the Referee Association? So it shows you how big this problem is. However, I have made some lifelong friends, been to some wonderful stadiums. I was lucky to get to professional level, and I've met some wonderful people at football clubs and volunteers. But what seems to be happening is the horrible people of football seem to be having more of an influence on the game, because the good people, you know, don't want to challenge them, which we understand, or they're just not as in your face as these bad people are. And of course, you know, good news isn't news, is it? You know, just saying, oh, nothing happened today in this game doesn't sell newspapers and doesn't get clickbait. So we understand the predicament that the media's in. But from our point of view, we've sort of leveraged that to say, look, is this really acceptable? And the things that go on in a game. And we know the majority of the time it doesn't happen. But we know there's at least 3 or 4 a week assaults on referees, which really, when you think about it, is awful.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't accept it if you know, that sort of figure, again, with similar sort of numbers in a small village. If there were 3 or 4 people being attacked every week, you wouldn't accept it.
No, you wouldn't. And if you think about it, you know, if the FA, Andy Ambler, who's come out this week, one of the major, major progressive moves by the FA, and he must be applauded for this, is Andy Ambler is one of the hierarchy of the FA. This isn't just some meat and two veg FA employee. This is the ex-chief executive of Millwall Football Club. He's no idiot. He's a switched on guy. Now, he's gone out in the public, out on the radio, out on the TV, saying we've got a problem and we're trying to address it. To us, that is a wonderful move. For too long, the FA has just put soulless statements out and soulless hashtags and respect campaigns that have had no real effect on the game. But to see this come out now and get him going front of house saying, look, we're going to try and do something like that, then announcing the body cam trial could start next week is such a wonderful, wonderful move. And the FA, particularly Andy Ambler and Danny Neeson at the referee department of the FA at Wembley, needs to be applauded for this and congratulated on trying to get hold of it and make a big difference. So we're really pleased about that development.
Andy Ambler, old friend of this show as well, and again, we'll applaud him, and he is someone that, you know, he does listen. He does listen, you know, and I mentioned week in, week out about club officials, league administrators, people at the FA. Nobody does a role in football to make another life more difficult. And I think that sometimes the way people see referees as well, isn't it? You know, we don't do it at this level, but particularly for money or reward. We do it for the love of the game. And that's so true for referees as well.
It is. And referees, you know, I know they're always getting stick, and we're always getting stick about saying we're not accountable. And, you know, we leave the game with our money in our back pocket, and, you know, it's fresh from having a sausage roll and some chips, and off we go and we forget about it. Trust me, that does not happen. It does not happen. The referees beat themselves up about it. I've done it myself when I was refereeing. You know, I know I made a mistake, and sometimes you're a little bit scared to admit the mistake, because the hostility of them asking you questions about was that a penalty, was that a red card. So I just think there's only a slight temperature change in how we address match officials, where I think everyone would get what they want. Referees don't want to make mistakes. They don't want to have, you know, a bad game. It's like a player doesn't want to miss a penalty. And it just happens. And I think having an environment that's a bit more conducive to going, do you know what, yeah, I did get that wrong, I'm sorry. And I think having the relationship between clubs and referees that allows that to happen, I don't think that's too far away at the majority of these good clubs we have in non-league football.
Yeah, we talk about the non-league family, and it makes so much sense to embrace everybody that's involved in that, including the officials. Now, you know, referees are human. We all are. So, you know, some days I'm next to useless or whatever task I'm trying to do. It happens. But I think people far too often forget that referees are human too, and have had a long day at work maybe on a Tuesday night. So, you know, sometimes we will make mistakes.
Mate, do you know what? You've just touched on something there that I could probably talk about 2 hours on, is this mid-week, you know, Tuesday night game. You know, as a referee coach, I'm always trying to make referees aware that, you know, players are rushing home from work. You've told the missus that they're going to be in late today. They left to go to work at 6 o'clock in the morning. They've worked all day. They've jumped on a coach. They might have lost a bit of money to get off work early, either an afternoon or whatever. And then they travel and they get there and they're a bit et up because, you know, they might be late because of traffic. They're going to be a little bit more wound up in a midweek than they have on a Saturday morning, and they have more time. And referees are no different. Some referees finish work themselves, and some referees are bricklayers. We're not all just accounting pen pushers like people think we are. You know, we've got Xboxes, we've got Dorman. You know, we're all real human people, and we've got those same challenges to get to a game with family life and work life. And I just think that the recognition of that from both parties is really important, particularly in bad weather. When, you know, you have lads out there and ladies out there, you know, making sure the pitch is all right, you know, getting the kitchen ready to cook food and make some extra money for the football clubs. All these go into the atmosphere of, you know, when you turn up, you might not look, you're up for it as a referee. You might not look like, you know, you're smart enough. All these little signals from the match official can just add to the temperature of the game. And last night, I went to Clevedon Town against Keynton Town in the Western League, which is only up the road from me, where I live.
We had the Clevedon Town, the chairman, on only a few weeks back.
Did you? Top, top club. And they're facing challenges like all football is. And it was just lovely to go in there. And we watched the referee, and we give our critique on the referee, what we thought. And, you know, we admitted, you know, maybe he couldn't have cautioned as many as he did. And having that conversation with an experienced referee like myself and the other lads that was with, it is really helpful. But what was really important is how the people at Clevedon and Keynsham, who weren't really that happy with the match officials, delivered their critique to us. It was very calm. It wasn't like, you know, veins popping out of their heads. It was a considered approach to it, and it was really refreshing to see that. You know, it was a cold night. You know, everything was going on in a match that normally gets on to prepare at that level of football. And you know, I that was a real good sign for me to realise that maybe that BBC article had thrown a bit of water on the flames of a lot of people in football, and thinking, well, actually, maybe I shouldn't have said things I've said to match officials and behaved the way I have towards match officials. So let's just see what happens going forward. But like I said earlier, mate, this body cam trial, I know you want to talk about it. This body cam trial could be an absolute game changer for the game at all levels. I really do think that's going to be a big, massive difference.
Yeah, and I don't think I've asked you this before on the show anyway. I'm no VAR fan, as most will know, because for me it creates a different game at the higher levels, and I'm not sure it works as well as it should anyway. But I just wonder whether the body cam thing might actually be a level playing field across football, and that will help referees. And this, I think VAR's sort of almost encouraged this... the need to question decisions.
Yeah. Listen, you know, I'm not a big fan of VAR myself, really. I think what people forget, that VAR isn't a machine. It's a process where there's still a human at the end of it that decides what to do. Yeah. And I think when that gets made clear a bit more, and the way we address VAR in stadiums for fans, there's a lot more work to do. And having Howard Webb come in, he absolutely nailed it over in America with VAR. He was a world leader in it. And I think we're going to see changes with what Howard's doing. Look what he's done already. There was some announcements made about referees making mistakes, came up very early. All these signs are there from the FA and the PGMOL, who run our top flight match officials, are there to understand what we are. That at that level, it is an entertainment business, and there's an awful lot of money on it. However, at the grassroots level in a body cam, it isn't just about referee abuse, body cams. It's about all forms of abuse. No one wants racial abuse, homophobic abuse, anti-Semitism, any form of abuse in the game. So this body cam pilot will address all forms of abuse, and it's going to be a deterrent, and it's going to be a training aid for the referee. I'm not naive enough to say that all referees are perfect, and maybe they might have said something or done something to a player that's wound them up and they've reacted and got sent off. That would be really, really, really naive of me to say that. So the body cam will also train the referee about how he or she talks to people and how they act to people and where they are in positions of the game, that they might have been in a different area to get a better view of a penalty or an elbow or a red card. So we're really excited about... We can't see anything, you know, a detriment to having body cams, so we're really excited about it.
And I think, you know, we cover the non-league game, but we've also got to think that the referees that are starting at grassroots football are our future non-league referees. Our non-league referees today are the future Premier League referees. But if you're at grassroots, you're a 14-year-old starting out in your referee career, and you're standing in the middle of the field and you've got no one around you to support you if there's an incident that goes off, whether that's on the field or whether that's something else happening in the crowd or maybe in the change rooms, you wouldn't expect a 14-year-old in any other scenario to be able to cope with that just alone without any other sort of backup. And that's where I think these body cameras just help with their confidence as well.
No, I think you're right. I think you absolutely nailed it. And one of the important things where, you know, well, this isn't by any means, body cameras isn't by any means a silver bullet that's going to cure the problem. It's going to be an absolute hell of a tool to have in a referee's toolbox to address it. And we did a bit of a trial where we used real body cameras and fake body cameras in some leagues across the country. To be honest, we never told BFA. Just, you know, could we get a bit of trouble for it? But we just did it ourselves to get some evidence. And it absolutely worked a treat. And there was no difference from a fake body camera to a real body camera and how people reacted to the referee. They all changed. They all changed their attitude. And some people were saying, tell you what, ref, if you never had that on, I would have given you a bit more stick. So we know they work. Even before this pilot, we know they work. So I think we've got to concentrate on the fact that it's going to pick up good things.
Yeah.
There's lots of good things that happen in football. There's good incidents, you know, an opponent helping someone up off the floor, particularly at youth level, someone helping someone on the sidelines, positive encouragement. All that's going to be captured by body cams too. So it isn't just about the negativity in the game. It's about promoting the positivity in the game. And I think everybody wants that.
Yeah, and it isn't all doom and gloom, is it? Because I've been sent this afternoon a glorious photograph of 18 young people, male and female, at my club Hayes and Yedding, taking and passing their referees' badges this week during their half term. They've given up their time during the half term. That's not only a great achievement for them and for the club, but I think it's going to make them better players too.
I think it will. It makes them better individuals if they're protected. And it's absolutely brilliant to see your club getting involved in that. So absolutely fair play to you. It's the next step. It's keeping them in the game, that journey. You know, the FA have historically always recruited the same amount of referees that they've lost. What's happened, and Andy Ambler confirmed that yesterday or the day before, that there actually isn't a shortage of referees. They've actually got 1,000 more than they did pre-COVID. But the problem is that he didn't really touch on it, and I understand why he didn't touch on it, is that they have got the same amount of registered referees, but the amount of referees that were going out and being active has dropped significantly. That's the problem. So in real terms, statistically, we haven't got a problem with numbers. But going out and having finding referees to blow the whistle on a Sunday morning, Saturday afternoon, etc., that's where the problem is, because people have, post-pandemic, found something a bit more enjoyable to Zoom in with the families or whatever, or you think, you know what, I'd rather earn more money, cost of living crisis, doing overtime than doing refereeing. So there's lots of little nuances in this that I think once we get further away from the pandemic and football settles down a little bit, I think I'm very confident that it all will be good. And seeing these messages from people like Andy Ambler and Danny Neeson at the FA, to us, a real positive sign that, you know, we're going to have a bright future. But, you know, let's see what happens.
Yeah, indeed. Let's see what's happening. I've never really understood why so many players are signed to pro clubs as scholars and featuring academies, whether that's private or club run, but they never do their referees course. To me, that's like trying to learn to drive a car by watching cars just driving past you. Surely you need to know the rules, like a referee does, to understand how the game works.
Yeah, and the FA historically has been accused of, like, you train referees to pass the test, they don't name them, don't train them as a referee. You know, things develop like passing the driving test. You know, when you get out on a motorway, it's very different when you haven't got, you know, someone sat next to you. So it's important to recognise that the way the FA has developed and their training at the basic referees course has changed fundamentally over the years. They've also shortened it, because it used to be like, you know, 6 or 7 weeks. So the commitment was a lot more for an individual to take the referees course. But I think what is really important is that we lobbied for 4 years for this body cam pilot. We lobbied for a long time alone at this charity. We wrote to IFAB, who were obviously the lawmakers of football. We wrote to the FA many times. And initially, the two people that were controlling the referee in this country, they emailed back and would say, look, the FA haven't got an appetite for body cams. That was the word they were using, which really frustrated us. And then they changed the Law 5 in football law, which under referee, to say no cameras or recording devices. And that was a real reckless move by them. But those two individuals have left the FA, and within a year of them leaving the FA, we had this positive change. So one of the things that always worried us, that there was people in the FA who were making unilateral decisions on behalf of the organisation as a whole. And I think that's what Andy's addressed. There's more accountability within decision-making now. It's a lot more transparent in the atmosphere within refereeing. There's more referees coming forward when they've got problems, which never used to happen. And I think this body cam trial, which honestly, only 2 years ago, we were just hitting brick walls. And I don't know anyone in football, apart from the people who can't control themselves, the people that lack some emotional intelligence, are against this. I'm really excited, as you can probably tell.
Yeah, and I'm excited too, because you're excited. And on the back of a news story which sounded so negative at the start of the week, it's just great to get you on and show the positive side of refereeing, the positive side of people enjoying their football, because without referees, we can't enjoy our football.
No, we can't. And I've said I've made lifelong friends purely from refereeing. I've took my family, my children, my wife to some of the best football grounds in this country, at non-league and at professional level, would never have done that. I've learned some skills, some soft skills, some harder skills, like dealing with confrontation and how you manage people, purely through taking up the whistle. I was an ex-player. I only took up refereeing because I was banned. I got a 100-day ban because I moved from Liverpool, from Anfield, one of the roughest areas in Europe at the time, a council estate, to Somerset. So I had to acclimatise too. So I sort of understood the differences in refereeing in the countryside to refereeing in the city, believe it or not, it was very different back then. And then I even used to referee my first season and a half. I used to wear shin pads as a referee because I couldn't get my head out, pulling my football socks up and not having shin pads in. So what happens is when I go for the toss and they have my flags under my arm and carrying the ball, people would say, oh my God, ref, you must have some rough games if you could have wear shin pads. But what I recognised was that was a great icebreaker. And so I realised really, really early in my career that you need to have something to connect to the players. Mine was shin pads, but with the shin pads, then I use the personality. So when I coach referees, I always talk about that bit, which is a great skill to have in life and employability, about connecting with people, and then you're more likely to be able to manage them positively.
Well, as ever, Martin, as I said, we could talk forever. I'm pleased I connected with you once again. Just before I let you go, just remind people, if they want to be a referee or if they already are a referee, where they can find out more about Ref Support.
Yeah, Ref Support UK are www.refsupport.co.uk. We've also got a 24/7, 365-day-a-year helpline, which is 0300 311 1966, the year England won the World Cup. And if you're interested in refereeing, get in touch with your county FAs or go to the FA.com, look for referees, qualify, take the course, have a look at it. And if you're struggling for kits, we have got a kit bank where people donate to us funds that we solely spend on getting new referees kits for young referees or people who's put on weight and can't afford a new kit. So there's lots of opportunities where we can even pay for the referees course for you. And we don't want anything back. We just want you to enjoy the whistle and experience the positive side of refereeing.
The positive side of refereeing coming from Martin Cassidy, who probably is one of the most positive sides of refereeing. Thanks again for joining us on the Non-League Football Show. Keep up the great work and we'll speak to you again very soon.
My pleasure, mate. Thank you for being interested in such a serious subject.
Now, I'd imagine the majority of our listeners are hardened football goers, and even if the traffic and weather was bad, they'd never contemplate leaving a game before the final whistle. I wonder how many, though, made that fatal error on Tuesday night. It was cold, it was a little foggy, and it was, well, a near the bottom of the league match in the Isthmian Premier League. Wingate and Finchley were trailing 3-0 at home to Bowers and Pitsy, and there were 82 minutes gone. Surely it was all over. Apparently not, as the home side grabbed 4 late goals, including 2 in injury time, with their goalkeeper even getting on the score sheet. So to tell us more, please welcome to the Non-League Football Show, Wingate and Finchley, our director of football, manager, everything else that goes with it, Ahmed Rifat. Welcome to the show, Ahmed.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's good to get you on. Now, let's look back. 82 minutes. Did you deserve to be 3-0 down on 82 minutes on Tuesday night?
The first half, I thought we were on top and we had a few chances that maybe we should have put away, but that wasn't the case. It sort of gave us a good platform to move on into the second half. But we didn't come out the second half at all. And they were probably the better side second half, and they took their chances when they got them. And I'd say they deserve to be leading. Maybe 3-0 was a bit of a push, but yeah, they definitely deserve to be leading.
Yeah, because I think looking at the stats here, it was 0-0 at halftime too. So was there ever any indication in that first half that they might end up with 7 goals at the end of the full time?
No indication whatsoever. It was quite a tight game. You know, I think where we both are in the table, it kind of not showed as in quality wise, but showed, you know, maybe a little bit nervous or who was going to be more risky, because I don't think either team really wanted to lose and allow the other team to sort of gain any ground on each other. So it was a bit of a tight game. So there wasn't no indication of it, of 7 goals flying in anyway.
And so 83 minutes gone, and then you grab your first goal. Dylan Kearney, I think, someone I know well from my time at Hayes and Yedding, his time at Hayes and Yedding. You score your first. Is there then a sense of urgency to get the game back underway? Is it one of those where the players suddenly grab the ball, wrestle it from the keeper and put it back on the spot for the kickoff?
Yeah, it was. Dylan, when he loves scoring goals, still, I've got to say. And when he scored, he looked like he wanted to go off and celebrate, and he And then I think he realised, he thought, I better grab the ball. And he grabbed the ball and he ran back to the centre circle. And then, anything can happen. We put a little bit of pressure on. And listen, 9 times out of 10, or normally 10 times out of 10, you don't maybe get anything, or especially not recover from 3-0 down at that speed. But credit to the boys. From that moment there, they sort of had a spring in their step, because previous to that, we did look a little bit dead and buried.
But then you get that, you make it 3-2, 88 minutes, I think Dylan again grabs a second. It really is game on again, particularly because, as you say, your two clubs in a similar position, nearer the bottom of the table. There's a lot to play for. It's one of those 3-point games that actually could be 6 points come the end of the season.
Yeah, listen, there was pressure on it. When we've played teams sort of in and around us, we haven't performed to what we should do, especially when we've played teams of sort of in the top half. So when we did get back to 3-2. The boys had that little bit of belief, and you could see it. And Bowers, even though they were trying to say the right things, you could see the sort of energy be sapped from them. And it was definitely game on to try get the third. And there were two penalties, so the first two goals were penalties, and we made a sub with Sammy coming on, Sammy Omprion, and which was his actual debut. He came on the sub and made a big impact and won both penalties. And when you see with penalties, once you see it, they're giving away penalties, they're sort of panicking or maybe being a little bit rash. And so we knew that we could. It was just a matter of if we could do it within the space of time that we had left, which was really little.
And then I guess it's one of those, sometimes as a manager, you're looking for the referee to blow his whistle as quickly as possible. It's one of those when you're suddenly hoping that slot of injury time or time added on or whatever they want to call it, is long enough for you to get back into the game. And I suppose if you were a Hollywood scriptwriter looking for your side to make a comeback from 3-0 down, you still need that little extra twist, don't you? So, of course, goalkeeper Ben Good comes on up and gets on the score sheet for the equaliser.
Yeah, so the Lino, we knew there would be quite a bit of injury time because one of their players went down for a little bit. So we knew, I'll be honest, I was probably looking at five minutes, and then the Lino said 7, which was great news to us. And then, like I say, it just gives everyone a little bit, the 7 minutes gives everyone a little bit of that little bit of extra boost and belief that we can still nick one. And Goody came up, and then we had an initial corner and Goody got his head onto it and it deflected off for another corner. And then so he had a second bite at it and got his head on it again. And it just creeped over the line. Their keeper was unlucky to not hook it out, but the Lino flagged for it to be over the line. And I'll be honest, at that point, I thought we just salvaged the point. And didn't realise and didn't ever think that, can we get another one? Even though we did tell to the team, listen, we need to push and press straight from the kickoff, because you just never know. And I say maybe luck was on our side that day, or we created our own luck. But yeah, we ended up getting that little final push.
And is this right? It was sort of like the 96 minute plus. It sort of was sort of one of those final kicks of the game, deep into injury time.
Yeah, so it literally was 97 on the 97th minute when we got the final goal. It was a long ball back into their sort of danger edge of the box, danger zone, and again Sammy who came on for his debut won the flick on, and then another substitute Elliot Long, who also made a very good impact in the game, put the cross in the box, and then Vass and Antonis. He popped up at the back post with a vital goal. And for me, it's something that we deserve, because the effort that they've put in the last three games, when we had a heavy defeat against Lewis, and then even in that game, the second half, credit to the players, they never gave up in that game. And for me, it was a turning point and a little bit of a belief in, we're in the fight and we're ready for the fight. And the last three games, the players have proved that. And it was for me, it was deserved with the effort and work rate they've put in the last three games. We deserve to get a win out of that.
Yeah, because Fort going down from the division, it makes it a tough run in until the end of the season. So that sort of resolve that you showed on Tuesday night, it's got to give you great belief, particularly with those new players coming in as well. The buzz around in change rooms must be awesome at the moment.
Yeah, listen, it was great. And, you know, it's one of them special moments which doesn't happen often. So to win like that in basically last kick of the game, sometimes you get more out of it than winning a game comfortable 2-0. So hopefully we can use that positive energy that we have in the change room, especially over the last three games. We can use that positive energy going into the final pushes and the final run-in of the season, which I'm confident, as long as the players keep working as hard as they have been and don't take anything for granted, then I'm confident that we can stay in this league and hopefully push on.
Yeah, from your time as a player and now off the field there as well at Wingate and Finchley, you probably know the club well as anybody, I would have thought. It's fair to say that it's punched above its weight for many years with some great use of resources and great resolve, again, shown on Tuesday night. But I look at your division this season, it's possibly the most competitive yet.
Yeah, no, I've been at the club a very long time, 15 or 16 years as a being at the club, you know, 14 years as a player, I had over 450 games. Should have been definitely more, but other reasons, though, which we won't say, I didn't probably reach as many games as I should have done. But yeah, I've been there a long time. You know, it's a special club for me. You know, we've had highs and lows of getting promoted from the league below and then being in this league and then reaching the playoffs in this league, not quite getting what we wanted, and with a promotion. Then the other side of things is also being in a relegation battle as a player, and staying up. And yeah, it's good to have them experiences as a player, and hopefully I can use that experience to pass on to this group of players, which obviously we don't want to be in this situation again. But it's experience that they can take on, because we have quite a young squad. So it's an experience that they can all learn from, and hopefully not be in that same situation.
Yeah, and talking of experience, I suppose a big question is was all of the action on Tuesday night captured on video, or is it going to be one of those non-league folklore type stories that only a handful of folk will ever really experience?
It was caught on video. We've put the goals out on social media. They are putting highlights together, because it's something that is, like I say, doesn't happen often. So we probably do need to get out there. And again, for us and for the club, where we don't have too many supporters, but we have the supporters that we do have are quality. Mm. But where we don't have so many, it's probably an opportunity for us to see if we can get more people through the door and get more people behind the team. If like social media is obviously a big tool, and you know it can attract, do a lot of good things for people in the club. So hopefully off the back of this, and even we scored a fantastic goal against Enfield the game before, which was really unbelievable from Vass as well, which has got a lot of attention. So hopefully over them last two games, and we can put them out there and hopefully get some more support through the door to help the boys.
So a trip to, I think, Horsham on Saturday in the league, is that a coach trip where maybe this video might be re-seen and re-watched again?
Yeah, it's a coach trip. I'm not sure if the coaches we have tellies on it to watch the game again, but it's a coach trip. It will be a difficult game. They're a very good side who play very good football. They do try to pass it, and they play at a high intensity. So, you know, we're in for a tough game, but something that we're looking forward to. We drew with them earlier on in the season, and maybe we could have nicked the 3 points then. So it'll be a tough game, but it's something that we're looking forward to, because I do feel that we play better and we rise to the occasion when we have to play against them type of teams.
Well, Armand, I love your calmness, and you know, particularly on the back of a result like that and a game like that. I'm not sure what your blood pressure would have been sort of on 83, 84 minutes, but you certainly sound nice and calm now. And it's a pleasure to get you on the Non-League Football Show, because as I say, you are Mr. Wingate and Finchley through and through. Thanks for joining us on the show, and best of luck for the rest of the season.
No, thank you for having me, Jim. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Time then to head on over to Non-League Paper Towers. Well, welcome back to the Non-League Football Show. It's Executive Editor at the Non-League Paper, Mr. John Couch. Welcome back, John.
Thank you, Tim. How are you?
Yeah, another busy week in the world of Non-League. Another sad week as well. Let's start with the sad news this week of the death of Brian Lee. Most probably best known in non-league circles, I guess, for his time as chair of the conference from 2007 before he became the president when the league changed its name to the National League. I think that was, 2015. The thing, you know, I think I wanted to get across, he had such an impact across non-league and the game of football that many may only just be realising now. He was a leading light in the formation of the National League Trust when he was there, and which has helped so many community projects in recent years. But he was also a founder member of the Isthmian League Management Committee, a league he had a long association with too from his time at Wycombe Wanderers, where I think he managed them to the Championship four times, runners-up twice, as well as later becoming director of the club, which I had many a conversation with him on. And I always found him a very genuine and engaging chat, one-to-one as well. And I loved engaging him in conversation about how things had changed over time. His first job in football, I think, was at Bisham Abbey as a coach, and he played a big part in the development of the Centre of Excellence there and Lillishall sort of later on. And I think I'm correct in saying he was sort of managed one of the first England semi-professional teams as well. I think anybody who ever met him will probably mourn his loss. And I understand there's going to be a minute silence at matches across the National League this weekend as a mark of respect.
Yeah, I think that'll be a fitting tribute to someone who has literally had non-league football in his heart, and it just been a lifelong passion. I mean, the word legend is used pretty lightly at some point, but that nobody comes to Brian Lee. But Brian Lee is. As your introduction stated, he's been there, done that for many, many years. He's served on many, many committees and got through some big, big moments, you know, and what's the word I'm looking for? But big sort of institutions and big times for non-league football to evolve and to become what it is now. And he's been a big player behind non-league football and its development, and in all sorts of areas, whether it be sort of management or boardroom level. And as I say, just a nice guy to boot as well, isn't he? And it's a very, very sad loss, and sad for non-league football, but at the same time, you know, because he continued to become such a big player so late on in life, you know, non-league football, I think, can celebrate what he's done for it, and can sort of look forward now, basically having had that platform that he built.
Yeah, and I think it's as ever, as an administrator in football, you're never going to win everybody over as a friend and influence them. And I think, you know, from my conversations with Brian later on, that was something that didn't upset him as much, but I think it made him a little bit sad that he always tried to understand and sort of empathise from a club's point of view, because he'd been there, as he said, you know, as a coach, as a manager, as a chairman. I think one, you know, talking about the things that he'd done at Wycombe, which was a club close to me over the years, you know, he'd taken them from a members club to a limited by guarantee club. So all the governance side of things, he always took an interest in other clubs looking to do that and trying to secure their future. I think he was influential as well and sort of played a big part in them moving to Adams Park at Wycombe Wanderers, you know, from their old grounds as well. So he had all this experience, and he was always hoping and trying to set free that information and give it, impart it to other people as well, so that their clubs could benefit and football as a whole could benefit.
Yeah, I think, and you have to look at his club, Wickham, to draw that as a comparison to non-league football as a whole. I mean, what he's done for Wickham, as you say, brought them up from a very, very small entity to what it is today, a championship football club. And Wickham Wanderers will be the first to say that that Brian Lee played a very big part of that over the years, and it's the same with non-league football. He's brought non-league football up from an unknown and not as well respected entity to what it is today. And again, Brian Lee is a huge part of that, but at the same time, he was always very grounded. He understood what clubs have to go to. He understood the importance and the role of volunteers and clubs that wouldn't necessarily bring in that kind of revenue that the bigger clubs could, and he would try everything he could to help. And he was just a well-rounded, and to say someone who understood the game and understood the roles of people who made non-league football tick. And he's going to be sadly missed.
Yeah, I think there'll be many for years to come. His legacies, the things that he's helped put in place, will have an impact on football for many more years to come. So hopefully, his name will be well respected as well for those years to come. Now, elsewhere on the in terms of personnel, the football calendar's back in full flow, so that means also the managerial merry-go-round appears to be on Super Whiz again. You know, it's sped up. I spoke to Matt Badcock last week. We just missed the appointment at the end of last week of Simon Lane moving from Westfield to the vacancy at Leatherhead. Tough job, but one I'm sure he's enthused with to take on there. But there's been a number of departures elsewhere this week. Some big names too. Jay Lovett leaving Burgess Hill Town. A little bit of a surprise to me, especially just hours, I think, after he'd signed and won 2-0 over Haywards Heath Town.
Yeah, that was quite a surprise to me as well. I mean, Jay had a good first season. Well, I say first full season. He'd actually been there over 3 years, but he was one of those managers that the COVID period really hit hard. So he actually only had one full season out of three and a half at Burgess Hill, and they could have just outside the playoffs. So they had a very good run of things. Unfortunately, hasn't quite gone their way this year. It's pretty tight down the bottom there. But they were just about treading water, and as you say, they had a very big derby win for them on Tuesday night at Haywards Heath, and 24 hours later he's gone, which is a little bit of a surprise. A big call, I think, but listening to the club's explanation, I think the decision was made before that Haywards Heath game. It was a bit of a big call after a big derby win, which everyone would have been very buoyant about. But it's also a very timely call. I think they'd have to have something in place, a plan be in place, because it's a little bit of a strange time to press the panic button, given the position they're in. I think there was. But judging by Tuesday night's result, there's still plenty left in the tank, and it's going to be sort of interesting to see there what they do from here on in.
Yeah, and also another big name departing and going to that managerial waiting room somewhere to see what bus might come along next. Rod Stringer and Brentwood Town have also announced that they've parted company this week.
Yeah, what's a strange one, really, because his CV is unbelievable. He's led some big clubs, notably Chelmsford and Braintree, over the years. He's someone who's he's someone who's been there, done that. He got in at Brentwood, and yeah, obviously hasn't quite worked out for him there. But there's a hugely talented manager there, especially at step three or four level, in that managerial waiting room, as you say. And I don't think it'll be long before Rod's back in a dugout.
One of those that's been sort of, you know, hanging around, you know, they'll be sure there'll be many of these back in the dugout very soon. But some great management pedigrees, you know, currently out of managerial jobs, and quite often, you know, like we found with our own Dave Anderson, who does promise me he will be back on the show very, very soon. But he's a bit busy down at Chertsey Town at the moment. The lure of management is just too much for most to deny for too long. And one of those he took a fairly high profile scouting job recently when he left management, but that even that wasn't enough for Michael Clegg. He stepped back in, back to the touchline in the vacant managerial role at Warrington Rylands.
That's right. Yeah, Michael Clegg is another big name in management, especially at step three level. Very well known, certainly in Northwest circles, and Warrington Rylands. I think that's a perfect fit for him. To be honest, they've had an excellent season. They found themselves without a manager, and you know, if you need someone to just to pick the pieces up and get their unlikely playoff run, I think after promotion last year, I think it's fair to say they probably weren't expected to have another playoff run again this year, but they have done. They've been excellent in that NPL Premier, and Michael Clegg is the perfect man to continue that.
Yeah, and I'm sure there'll be some more changes as the weeks progress and we move further towards the end of the season. And I look at the National League, and that's been fairly static, really, particularly this week in terms of managers keeping hold of their jobs and being allowed to continue with what they're doing. And you look at the National League, looking back to midweek, actually, Tuesday night again changed the top of the table somewhat. Notts County winning 3-1 over Barnet, and Wrexham and Woking holding each other to a 2-2 draw. That sees Notts, 5 points clear, but Wrexham 2 games in hand. It's a 46-game season, and we're pretty much two-thirds of the way through already. I'm guessing Chesterfield, 24 points off the top now, 3 games in hand. It does seem to be that two-horse race. Can you see anybody other than Notts County and Wrexham winning the title now?
No, not really. Not really. I think you're right. I think it's safe to say it is a two-horse race. Chesterfield have just fallen away, haven't they, the last few weeks. They had 3 defeats on the spin, and last chance saloon, I think, was at Aldershot on Tuesday night, and they can only get a 1-1 draw. So I think with the form that Notts County and Wrexham are in, I think it's probably safe to say that the title is going to one of those two. Tuesday night was actually a really, really interesting evening, because at one point Wrexham were beating Woking, and Notts County were only drawing with Barnet, who have been flying recently. So it really did look like a season-defining evening. And all of a sudden, Woking equalised at Wrexham, and Notts County found their feet and ended up bagging 3 more and ended up 4-1 winners. So eventually, those tables turned pretty simply, I think, pretty quickly. I think Wrexham are now 5 points behind with 2 games in hand. Memory serves me, so I mean it's all to play for, isn't it? Yeah, they're literally neck and neck at the moment, and none of them are really giving up much in the way of points. I can't wait, really. I think it's going to be a tremendous run to the finish, and whoever doesn't get there, you're not going to want in the playoffs, are you?
No, and you say, you know, it literally is neck and neck. You know, just a goal between them as well on that goal difference. But whatever happens, I'm pretty sure it's going to be a record-breaking one. You know, you've got Notts on, 77 points on paper already. Suggest they might even, you know, if Wrexham are going to go past them as well, they might challenge that 105 points that I think Crawley Town got to win the title in 2010-2011, because we've still got a third of the season to go.
Yeah, either of them could do it, couldn't they? I mean, you wouldn't be surprised if either of them went unbeaten until the end of the season. They're on such flying form, and they don't look like they're going to get breached anytime soon by anybody else. And it's like a bit like a Grand National sort of going around that final bend, and they're literally neck and neck. And the rest of the field, I think, are long behind, but they're just gathering pace all the time, aren't they? And it's going to be great. And I think it could go right down to the final week. And what a exciting prospect that'll be. Get big sort of 10,000 crowds at both stadiums in Wrexham. I'm sure would be more if they weren't rebuilding their stand, and we all know that Notts County are capable of big five figure crowds as well. So it promises to be an absolute cracker. None of them have got FA Trophy staying in the way. They're both out of the FA Trophy, so they've literally got nothing standing in their way now, and they can just go head to head for the title. And as you say, you wouldn't be surprised if both of them passed the 105 point mark. It's just been that kind of season.
Yeah. And we spoke earlier with Wingate and Finchley manager Matt Riffat about their 4-3 comeback midweek in the league. And you've mentioned there Notts County coming back and winning 4-1 in the week. It's just the National League, if you're one of those privileged, because it can be difficult to get into games now because of the size of the crowds. If you're there watching these games, they're exciting games as well, aren't they? The comebacks, you don't want to leave the game early. But some of the other records I'm thinking might be broken are the goal scoring records. I look at what we got there last season. Macaulay Langstaff, he hit 32 goals for Gateshead to win the title, but the National North title, he stepped up. He's already on 26 goals this season. Topping the scoring charts in the National League at the moment. That's the same number that Wrexham's Paul Mullin scored last season to earn him the Golden Boot. And he's on 22 goals at the moment. So I think with Langstaff and Mullin sort of battling for that Golden Boot this season, there's a chance that one of them could maybe get near the 40 goals that Ricky Miller netted for Dover. When was that? That was, 2016, 2017, I think, around that era?
Yeah, I saw a tweet from Ricky Miller, and someone suggested that.
Oh, again, he's still plying his trade as a striker in non-league. He's sort of.
Yes, he is. Yes, he is. Yeah, he's someone I know well, and he replied to the tweet with a sort of cheeky, not a chance. But I'm sure he'll be looking over his shoulder, because you wouldn't back against any of them doing it. I mean, I don't. Macaulay Langstaff has just had his unbelievable first season. In the National League after his exploits for Gateshead last year, and to be honest, I think it was probably the best bit of business that they could have done in January just to keep hold of him. I'm sure there was. I'm sure there must have been a whole line of suitors waiting to take him, and I'm sure there will be in the summer as well. And Paul Mullin, we all know what Paul Mullin could do. He showed it in front of the TV cameras during Wrexham's FA Cup run. Just the fact that he's a League One or Two striker plying his trade in the National League. He's as good as anything. He's as good as anything in that level, at that level, in my opinion. And the way that they create chances, both Notts County and Wrexham, you can see that it's just, yeah, an absolute dream for strikers of that calibre. And I wouldn't be surprised to see them. Well, I think they're pretty easily both get in the 30s. So whether one of them can push Ricky's record remains to be seen, but they won't be far away.
And I also think Macaulay as well, it's worth noting that he's not new to non-league, is he? He's still young, very very much younger compared to myself. I think only 25, 26. He's been around in non-league. He's scored goals, and further down the pyramid, and sort of in previous spells. I think it was at York for a while, wasn't he? He's been around, but he had that great season last season, and I think it shows when the strength of non-league and how good the players are in non-league now. They're all, but and higher up, the higher up you go into the National League, everybody's pulling each other's levels up, I think, and everybody's learning off one another, and that means that the standard of non-league is probably the best it's ever been.
Yes, very much so. And also, I think you have to give some of the managers credit for that as well. You know, that some of these managers, I'm thinking of Gateshead and Macaulay Langstaff's development really at Gateshead under Mike Williamson. That would have been a huge for him. I mean, Mike Williamson obviously been there, done that, and you know, I think that's probably where he moved up in, into the next level, as you say. But he's someone, he's not some 18, 19-year-old kid who's just come out of someone's academy with plenty of talent. He's someone who's learned his trade from much lower down the pyramid, and he's just getting stronger and stronger. And as you say, you know, to go into the Football League, which I'm sure he will do next season, whether it be with Notts County or not. But to go in there at 27, he's perfectly primed, really, to push his career onto a next level. And it wouldn't surprise me to see him go even higher than that, even higher than League Two next season. But as you say, he's not the only one. There are plenty of others. Wrexham are full of young lads as well who have done that, despite the money that they've spent. There are a lot of young lads who have come through the ranks, and they're ready to go as well. And it's great for non-league football as a whole, isn't it? You know, that all these young lads are coming through, and you only have to look at the number of players that went to the promoted clubs into League Two over the last couple of years. You know, the Suttons and the Hartlepools and the Harrogates, you know, the Barrows. They've all recruited out of non-league and I've done pretty well in League Two. There's really not a great deal of difference between the two, I don't think.
No, but while they're with us, we'll still enjoy them. We'll enjoy them certainly, hopefully, till the end of the season and watch that National League title race further unfold. I'm sure there'll be many more twists and turns, of course. One other piece of news creating a stir on social media this week. I saw Bitton AFC resigned from Step 5 this season. They're readying themselves, apparently, for a return with an application to rejoin at Step 6. Much debate as to whether that's fair to clubs who have seen out the season in a relegation battle at Step 5 this term. And it's something I think we discussed when they announced their resignation as well. You know, should there be, you know, for clubs resigning midway through a season, should there be an automatic two-level drop down the steps? Or is that not realistic in terms of size of clubs and the way that the pyramid works?
Yeah, I did see that. I'm not so sure, to be honest. I think it's one of those situations where if there are plenty of clubs in their area or in the league's jurisdiction who are knocking on the door, then I think maybe there is. It's quite an unusual case in the fact that Bitton they're a big Step 5 club. Mm. I think they were FA Vars quarter finalists or maybe even semi finalists. I'm not so sure. Not very long ago. So you're talking an elite Step 5 club who, for one reason or another, have been forced to quit their league. But now they've got their house in order. You think, well, would they properly serve Step 7 playing in a local league against sides with nowhere near as many as good of facilities or
and there's the costs that come, the burdens that come to those clubs that then got to host them because there's, you know, high supporters and sort of the actual practicalities of it become even more of a headache, I think, don't they?
Yeah, that's right. I do get both sides. You could say it's not fair. If you're a Step 7 club and you bought your way up to the top of your league and you're ready to go into Step 6, i.e. senior football, then you would be a little bit miffed, wouldn't you? But this is as we say, this is an elite Step 5 club. I think the whole area will be delighted to see them back. I think not only football will be delighted to see them back because no one likes to see clubs who have been successful forced out of a league. So I think it's great to see them back. And I think if the leagues or the in their jurisdictions can find a way to accommodate them back and get better Britain AFC back to where they were, I think it's good for everyone concerned.
Yeah, and we've got to look at that wider sustainability model across football as well. And you know, in a similar line, maybe a worrying trend. It saw two clubs this week seemingly lose good board leaders come the end of the season. They're looking to hand over the reins to new people. Simon Bullard, chairman at AFC Dunstable, step four, said he's going to step down at the end of the season and will gift the club debt-free to anybody that proves that they have the ability and resource to run a team or club at that level. Hensford Town as well, with Graham Jones and Hayden Dando, the chair and vice chair of their announcing that they're going to do the same along similar lines, step back and hand the club to anybody that's got that ability and resource to take over the club. It probably says a lot about the issues that are facing those running clubs at the moment. It's never easy. You've got two clubs here that have got their clubs to a debt-free position, but the short-term future in particular, it's a little bit bleak.
Yeah, very much so. There does seem to be a spate of it at the moment, where sort of clubs have sort of reached their pinnacle almost, and you know, sort of don't really know where to turn. It's funny you said it, because we've got a feature going in our paper this week on Farnborough. It's actually going in as an advertorial, and Farnborough are going extremely well in National League South, and one defeat in 16, and they're 6 points off the playoffs with four games in hand. And there's actually a concern, and I say the word concern, that they are concerned that if that form continues and they get themselves into some kind of promotion setup, then what would happen then? Because they don't feel that they could be competitive in the top league. So they're looking at investors and trying to find a way that can help propel them to the next level as well. And I suppose in their respect, and others as well, they're victims of their own success. And but when you get to the dizzy heights of the National League, and you come up against teams or clubs that we've just been talking about, like Wrexham and Notts County, it's all pretty daunting. And to compete with those guys, you've got to have something behind you. And I think it's filtered all the way down the pyramid. Now, you mentioned Hensford. You know, Hensford are a very famous club who have struggled of late this season, sadly, at step three. But that just goes to show how strong non-league football is. You know, you only have to have one. One quiet season or lose your way just a little bit and it swallows you up. So, I don't think it's any coincidence that chairman and presidents or what have you and commercial guys are up in their game or looking to change things for the future, because it's getting bigger and bigger all the time.
No, I look forward to learning more about that, because it is, I think, with the competitiveness of the pyramids across the divisions, it is great. The new pyramid formation getting a bit more sorted out is great, but the fact that in most divisions you've got two going up and four going down means that it can be a massive difference between running your club well and running your club very well could be the difference between staying up or going down. And I think that's going to be a headache that many off the field clubs are looking at. They're, where's the sustainability? Is it sustainability as a club, or is it sustainability at level? And there's many questions going that need to be answered at the moment, and hopefully they'll be addressed by ourselves and yourselves over the coming weeks. So what else can we expect to read in this weekend's paper then, John?
Well, we've got a lot of FA VARs and FA Trophy response, really, and reaction. Obviously, the quarterfinal draws were made this week. We're focusing more heavily on the VARs this week. We're going to leave the trophy to more of a preview. So we've actually spoken to all eight VARs quarterfinalists. We're planning a big, a nice feature on those guys. Notably, Newport Pagnell Town, who are obviously the holders, who just I just can't lose in this competition. Don't know they've been pushed to the limit many, many times. Jersey Bulls were the last team to do so, but they just seem to find a way of getting over the line, don't they? So they're going to take some beating, and we've got plenty going on. As I said, nice piece on Farmer Brian Lee. Of course, we got a nice tribute to Brian Lee, and obviously plenty of league action. We've got some stuff on York City. Obviously, there's a few problems in there. Problems as to shares and with the majority owner Glenn Henderson offering his shares down to the supporters trust. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes. But plenty more to read on Sunday, and look forward to hopefully another good day of action on Saturday.
Well, we look forward to a good day of action on Saturday, a good read on Sunday as well. And John Couch, thanks as ever for joining us on the Non-League Football Show. Have a great week.
Thank you very much. Cheers, Tim.
And that's it then for this week. I hope you enjoyed the slightly different topics this week. It is great to get to chat to old friends of the show, but also to just show the wonders of non-league football. It's so varied that the wider non-league football family and hopefully, you know, some of the stuff that Martin was saying and also AFAT as well, why we love non-league football and what else you can get involved with at non-league football level. Thanks as ever to all of my guests. Thank you to all of you for listening. Remember, you can follow us throughout the season and join in throughout the week on social media at Non-League Show. Myself there at Tim Fuel, F-U-E-L-L. And you can find us every week on Audio Boom, on Apple Podcasts, but also Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, CastBox, iHeart, Geo7, Listen Notes, Overcast, Podcast Addict, Podchaser, Radio Republic via your smart speakers and all good podcast aggregation sites. Stay safe. Enjoy your football. Thank you. And goodbye.
Jibber Jabber Production. JIBBA JABBA